farther up the shaft of that dendrite. The pumps have started working, pumping ions back to where they were in the first place. So at the end of that dendritic fibril, the charge went from minus 70 to minus 60 millivolts. But a little bit up the shaft of that fibril, things then go from minus 70 to minus 65 millivolts. Farther up the shaft, minus 70 to minus 69. In other words, that excitatory signal dissipates. You've taken a nice, smooth, calm lake in its resting state and tossed a little pebble in. It causes a bit of a ripple right there, which spreads outward, getting smaller in its magnitude until it dissipates not far from where the pebble hit. And miles away, at the lake's axonal end, that ripple of excitation has had no effect whatsoever. In other words, if a single dendritic fibril is excited, that's not enough to pass on the excitation down to the axonal end and on to the next neuron. How does a message ever get passed on? Back to that wonderful single neuron drawn by Cajal. That arborized array of bifurcating dendritic branches ends in lots of ends of fibrils. Time to introduce the term commonly used, ends in lots of dendritic spines. And in order to get sufficient excitation to sweep from the dendritic end of the neuron to the axonal end, you have to have summation. The same spine must be stimulated repeatedly, and or, more commonly, a bunch of the spinal neurons must be stimulated at once. You can't get a wave, rather than just a ripple, unless you throw in a lot of pebbles. At the base of the axon, where it emerges from the cell body, is a specialized part called the axon hillock. If all those summated dendritic inputs produce enough of a ripple to move the resting potential around the hillock from minus 70 millivolts to around minus 40 millivolts, a threshold is passed. And once that happens, all hell breaks loose. A different class of channels opens in the membrane of the hillock, which allows a massive migration of ions, producing, finally, a positive charge, about 30 millivolts. In other words, an action potential, which then opens up those same types of channels in the next smidgen of axonal membrane, regenerating the action potential there, and in the next, all the way down to the axon terminals. From an informational standpoint, a neuron has two different types of signaling systems. From the dendritic spines to the starts of the axon hillock, it's an analog signal, with gradations of signals that dissipate over space and time. And from the axon hillock to the axon terminals, it's a digital system with all or none signaling that regenerates down the length of the axon. Let's throw in some imaginary numbers. Suppose an average neuron has about 100 dendritic spines and about 100 axon terminals. What are the implications of this in the context of the analog/digital feature of neurons? Sometimes nothing interesting. Consider neuron A, which, as just introduced, has 100 axon terminals. Each one of those connects to one of the dendritic spines of the next neuron in line, neuron B. Neuron A has an action potential, which propagates down to all of its 100 axon terminals, which excites all 100 dendritic spines in neuron B. The threshold at the axon hillock of neuron B requires 50 of the dendrites to get excited around the same time, in order to generate an action potential. Thus, with all 100 of the dendrites firing, neuron B is guaranteed to get an action potential. Now, instead, neuron A projects half of its axon terminals to neuron B and half to neuron C. It has an action potential. Does that guarantee one in neurons B and C? Yes. Each of those neurons' axon hillocks has that threshold of needing a signal from 50 dendritic pebbles at once in order to have an action potential. Now instead, neuron A evenly distributes its axon terminals among 10 different target neurons, neurons B through K. Is it action potential going to produce action potentials in the target neurons? No way. Continuing our example, the 10 dendritic spines worth of pebbles in each target neuron is way below the threshold of 50 pebbles. So what will ever cause an action potential in, say, neuron K, which has only 10 of its dendritic spines getting excitatory signals from neuron A. Well, what's going on with its other 90 dendritic spines? They're getting inputs from other neurons, 9 of them, with 10 inputs from each. When will neuron B have an action potential? When at least half of the neurons projecting to it have action potentials. In other words, any given neuron integrates the inputs from all the neurons projecting to it, and out of this comes a rule. The more neurons that neuron A projects to, by definition, the more neurons it can influence. However, the more neurons it projects to, the smaller its average influence will be at each of those target neurons. There's a trade-off. This doesn't matter in the spinal cord, where one neuron typically sends all its projections to the next one in line. But in the brain, one neuron will disperse its projections to scads of other ones and receive inputs from scads of other ones, with each neuron's axon hillock determining whether the threshold is reached and an action potential generated. The brain is wired in networks of divergent and convergent signaling. Now to put in a flabbergasting real number. Your average neuron has about 10,000 dendritic spines and about the same number of axon terminals. Factor in 100 billion neurons, and you see why brains, rather than kidneys, write poetry. Just for completeness, here are a couple of final facts. Neurons have some additional tricks at the end of an action potential to enhance the contrast between nothing to say / something to say even more, two means of ending the action potential really fast and dramatically. Something called delayed rectification and another thing called the hyperpolarized refractory period. Another minor detail, a type of glial cell wraps around an axon, forming a layer of insulation called a myelin sheath. This myelination causes the action potential to shoot down the axon faster. And one final detail of great future importance. The threshold of the axon hillock can change over time, thus changing the neuron's excitability. What things change thresholds? Hormones, nutritional state, experience, and other factors filling this book's pages. We've now made it from one end of a neuron to the other. How exactly does a neuron with an action potential communicate its excitation to the next neuron in line? Two neurons at a time. Synaptic communication. So, an action potential has been triggered at the hillock in neuron A and has swept down to all 10,000 axon terminals. How is this excitation passed on to the next neuron or neurons? The defeat of the syncytiomites. For your average 19th century neuroscientist, the answer was easy. Their explanation would be that a fetal brain is made up of huge numbers of separate neurons that slowly grow their dendritic and axonal processes. And eventually, the axon terminals of one neuron reach and touch the dendritic spines of the next neuron or neurons, and they merge, forming a continuous membrane between the two cells. From all those separate fetal neurons, the mature brain forms this continuous, vastly complex net of one single superneuron, which was called a syncytium. Thus, excitation readily flows from one neuron to the next because they aren't really separate neurons. Late in the 19th century, an alternative view emerged, namely that each neuron remains an independent unit, and that the axon terminals of one neuron don't actually touch the dendritic spines of the next. Instead, there's a tiny gap between the two. This notion was called the neuron doctrine. The adherents of the syncytium school thought that the neuron doctrine was asinine. Show me the gaps between axon terminals and dendritic spines, they demanded of these heretics, and tell me how excitation jumps from one neuron to the next. And then in 1873, it all got solved by the Italian neuroscientist Camillo Golgi, who invented a technique for staining brain tissue in a novel fashion. And the aforementioned Cajal used this Golgi stain to stain all the processes, all the branches and branchlets and twigs of the dendrites and axon terminals of single neurons. Crucially, the stain didn't spread from one neuron to the next. There wasn't a continuous, merged net of a single superneuron. Individual neurons are discrete entities. The neuron doctriners vanquished the syncytiomites. Hooray! Case closed. There are indeed micro-microscopic gaps between axon terminals and dendritic spines. These gaps are called synapses, which weren't directly visualized, putting the last nail in the syncytial coffin until the invention of electron microscopy in the 1950s. But there's still that problem of how excitation propagates from one neuron to the next, leaping across the synapse. The answer, whose pursuit dominated neuroscience in the middle half of the 20th century, is that the electrical excitation doesn't leap across the synapse. Instead, it gets translated into a different type of signal. Neurotransmitters. Sitting inside each axon terminal, tethered to the membrane, are little balloons called vesicles, filled with many copies of a chemical messenger. Along comes the action potential that initiated miles away in that neuron's axon hillock. It sweeps over the terminal and triggers the release of those chemical messengers into the synapse, which they float across, reaching the dendritic spine on the other side, where they excite the neuron. These chemical messengers are called neurotransmitters. How do neurotransmitters, released from the presynaptic side of the synapse, cause excitation in the postsynaptic dendritic spine? Sitting on the membrane of the spine are receptors for the neurotransmitter. Time to introduce one of the great clichés of biology. The neurotransmitter molecule has a distinctive shape, with each copy of the molecule having the same. The receptor has a binding pocket of a distinctive shape that is perfectly complementary to the shape of the neurotransmitter, and thus the neurotransmitter, cliché time, fits into the receptor like a key into a lock. No other molecule fits snugly into that receptor. The neurotransmitter molecule won't fit snugly into any other type of receptor. Neurotransmitter binds to receptor, which triggers those channels to open, and the currents of ionic excitation begin in the dendritic spine. This describes transsynaptic communication with neurotransmitters. Except for one detail. What happens to the neurotransmitter molecules after they bind to the receptors? They don't bind forever. Remember that action potentials occur on the order of a millisecond. Instead, they float off the receptors, at which point the neurotransmitters have to be cleaned up. This occurs in one of two ways. First, for the ecologically minded synapse, there are reuptake pumps in the membrane of the axon terminal. They take up the neurotransmitters and recycle them, putting them back into those secretory vesicles to be used again. The second option is for the neurotransmitter to be degraded in the synapse by an enzyme, with the breakdown products flushed out to sea, i.e. the extracellular environment, and from there onto the cerebrospinal fluid, the bloodstream, and eventually the bladder. These housekeeping steps are hugely important. Suppose you want to increase the amount of neurotransmitter signaling across a synapse. Let's translate that into the excitation terms of the previous section. You want to increase excitability across the synapse, such that an action potential in the presynaptic neuron has more of an oomph in the postsynaptic neuron, which is to say it has an increased likelihood of causing an action potential in that second neuron. You could increase the amount of neurotransmitter released, the presynaptic neuron yells louder. Or you could increase the amount of receptor on the dendritic spine, the postsynaptic neuron is listening more acutely. But as another possibility, you could decrease the activity of the reuptake pump. As a result, less of the neurotransmitter is removed from the synapse. Thus, it sticks around longer and binds to the receptors repeatedly, amplifying the signal. Or, as the conceptual equivalent, you could decrease the activity of the degradative enzyme. Less neurotransmitter is broken down, so more sticks around longer in the synapse, having an enhanced effect. As we saw, some of the most interesting findings, that help explain individual differences in the behaviors that concern us in this book relate to amounts of neurotransmitter made and released and the amounts and functioning of the receptors, reuptake pumps, and degradative enzymes. Types of neurotransmitters. So what is this mythic neurotransmitter molecule released by action potentials from the axon terminals of all the 100 billion neurons? Here's where things get complicated, because there is more than one type of neurotransmitter. Why more than one? The same thing happens in every synapse, which is that the neurotransmitter binds to its key in a lock receptor and triggers the opening of various channels that will allow the ions to flow and makes the inside of the spine a bit less negatively charged. One reason is that different neurotransmitters depolarize to different extents, in other words, some have more excitatory effects than others, and for different durations. This allows for a lot more complexity in information being passed from one neuron to the next. And now, to double the size of our palate, there are some neurotransmitters that don't depolarize, don't increase the likelihood of the next neuron in line having an action potential. They do the opposite. They hyperpolarize the dendritic spine, opening different types of channels that make the resting potential even more negative, e.g. shifting from minus 70 millivolts to minus 80 millivolts. In other words, there are such things as inhibitory neurotransmitters. You can see how that has just made things more complicated. A neuron with its 10,000 dendritic spines is getting excitatory inputs of differing magnitudes from various neurons, getting inhibitory ones from other neurons, and integrating all of this at the axon hillock. Thus, there are lots of different classes of neurotransmitters, each binding to a unique receptor site that is complementary to its shape. Are there a bunch of different types of neurotransmitters in each axon terminal, so that an action potential triggers the release of a whole orchestration of signaling? Here is where we invoke Dale's principle, named for Henry Dale, one of the grand poobahs of the field, who in the 1930s proposed a rule whose veracity forms the very core of each neuroscientist's sense of well-being. An action potential releases the same type of neurotransmitter from all of the axon terminals of a neuron. Therefore, there will be a distinctive neurochemical profile to a particular neuron. Oh, that neuron is a neurotransmitter A-type neuron, and what that also means is that the neurons that it talks to have neurotransmitter A receptors on their dendritic spines. There are dozens of neurotransmitters that have been identified. Some of the most renowned, serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, acetylcholine, glutamate, the most excitatory neurotransmitter in the brain, and GABA, the most inhibitory. It's at this point that medical students are tortured with all the multisyllabic details of how each neurotransmitter is synthesized, its precursor, the intermediate forms the precursor is converted to until finally arriving at the real thing, the painfully long names of the various enzymes that catalyze the syntheses. Amid that, there are some pretty simple rules built around 3 points. A. You do not ever want to find yourself running for your life from a lion and, oopsies, the neurons that tell your muscles to run fast go offline because they've run out of neurotransmitter. Neurotransmitters are therefore made from precursors that are plentiful. Often they are simple dietary constituents. Serotonin and dopamine, for example, are made from the dietary amino acids tryptophan and tyrosine, respectively. Acetylcholine is made from dietary choline and lecithin. B. A neuron can potentially have dozens of action potentials a second. Each involves restocking the vesicles with more neurotransmitter, releasing them, and mopping up afterward. Given that, you do not want your neurotransmitters to be huge, complex, ornate molecules, each of which requires generations of stonemasons to construct. Instead, they are all made in a small number of steps from their precursors. They're cheap and easy to make. For example, it takes only 2 simple synthetic steps to turn tyrosine into dopamine. C. Finally, to complete this pattern of neurotransmitter synthesis as cheap and easy, multiple neurotransmitters can be generated from the same precursor. In neurons that use dopamine as the neurotransmitter, for example, there are two enzymes that do those two construction steps. Meanwhile, in norepinephrine-releasing neurons, there's an additional enzyme that converts dopamine to norepinephrine. Cheap, cheap, cheap. Which makes sense. Nothing becomes obsolete faster than a neurotransmitter after it has done its postsynaptic thing. Yesterday's newspaper is useful today only for house-training puppies. Neuropharmacology. As these neurotransmitterology insights emerged, they allowed scientists to begin to understand how various neuroactive and psychoactive drugs and medicines work. Broadly, such drugs fall into two categories, those that increase signaling across a particular type of synapse and those that decrease it. We already saw some of the strategies for increasing signaling. A. Stimulate more synthesis of the neurotransmitter, for example, by administering the precursor or using a drug that increases the activity of the enzymes that synthesize the neurotransmitter. As an example, Parkinson's disease involves a loss of dopamine in one brain region, and a staple of treatment is to boost dopamine levels by administering the drug L-DOPA, which is the immediate precursor of dopamine. B. Administer a synthetic version of the neurotransmitter, or a drug that is structurally close enough to the real thing to fool the receptors. Psilocybin, for example, is structurally similar to serotonin and activates a subtype of its receptors. C. Stimulate the postsynaptic neuron to make more receptors. Fine in theory, but not easily done. D. Inhibit degradative enzymes so that more of the neurotransmitter sticks around in the synapse. E. Inhibit the reuptake of the neurotransmitter, prolonging its effects in the synapse. The modern antidepressant of choice, Prozac, does exactly that in serotonin synapses. Thus, it is often referred to as an SSRI. A selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Meanwhile, a pharmacopoeia of drugs are available to decrease signaling across synapses, and you can see what their underlying mechanisms are going to include. Blocking the synthesis of a neurotransmitter, blocking its release, blocking its access to its receptor, and so on. Fun example, acetylcholine stimulates your diaphragm to contract. Curare, the poison used in darts by Amazonian tribes, blocks acetylcholine receptors. You stop breathing. A final, very relevant point. Just as the threshold of the axon hillock can change over time in response to experience, nearly every facet of the nuts and bolts of neurotransmitterology can be changed by experience as well. More than two neurons at a time. We have now triumphantly reached the point of thinking about three neurons at a time. And within not too many pages, we will have gone wild and considered even more than three. The purpose of this section is to see how circuits of neurons work, the intermediate step before examining what entire regions of the brain have to do with the best and worst of our behaviors. Therefore, the examples here were chosen merely to give a flavor of how things work at this level. Neuromodulation. Presynaptic inhibition. The axon terminal of neuron B forms a synapse with the dendritic spine of the postsynaptic neuron, let's call it neuron C, and releases an excitatory neurotransmitter, the usual. Meanwhile, neuron A sends an axon terminal projection onto neuron B, but not to a normal place, a dendritic spine. Instead, its axon terminal synapses onto the axon terminal of neuron B. What's up with this? Neuron A releases the inhibitory neurotransmitter GABA, which floats across that axoaxonic synapse and binds to receptors on that side of neuron B's axon terminal. And such an inhibitory effect, i.e. making that minus 70 millivolt resting potential even more negative, snuffs out any action potential hurtling down that branch of the axon, keeps it from getting to the very end and releasing neurotransmitter. In the jargon of the field, neuron A is having a neuromodulatory effect on neuron B. Sharpening a signal over time and space. Now for a new type of circuitry. To accommodate this, I'm using a simpler way of representing neurons. Neuron A sends all of its axonal projections to neuron B and releases an excitatory neurotransmitter. Now consider another circuit. Neuron A stimulates neuron B as usual. In addition, it also stimulates neuron C. This is routine, with neuron A splitting its axonal projections between the two target cells, exciting both. And what does neuron C do? It sends an inhibitory projection back onto neuron A, forming a negative feedback loop. Back to the brain, loving contrasts, energetically screaming its head off when it has something to say, and energetically being silent otherwise. This is a more macro level of the same. Neuron A fires off a series of action potentials. What better way to energetically communicate that it's all over than to become majorly silent, thanks to the feedback loop? It's a means of sharpening a signal over time. Neuron A can determine how powerful that negative feedback signal will be by how many of the 10,000 axon terminals it shunts toward neuron C instead of B. Such temporal sharpening of a signal can be accomplished in another way. Neuron A stimulates B and C. Neuron C sends an inhibitory signal onto neuron B that will arrive sometime after B starts getting stimulated, since the A-C-B loop is two synaptic steps versus one for A-B. Result, sharpening a signal with feed-forward inhibition. Now for another type of sharpening of a signal, of increasing the signal-to-noise ratio. Consider a six-neuron circuit, where neuron A stimulates B, C stimulates D, and E stimulates F. So neuron C sends an excitatory projection onto neuron D. But in addition, neuron C's axon sends collateral inhibitory projections onto neurons A and E. Thus, if neuron C is stimulated, it both stimulates neuron D and silences neurons A and E. With such lateral inhibition, C screams its head off while A and D become especially silent. It's a means of sharpening a spatial signal. And note, this is simplified in that I've omitted something obvious. Neurons A and E also send inhibitory collateral projection onto neuron C, as well as to the neurons on the other sides of them in this imaginary network. Lateral inhibition like this is ubiquitous in sensory systems. Shine a tiny dot of light onto an eye. Wait, was that photoreceptor neuron A, C, or E that just got stimulated? Thanks to lateral inhibition, it is clearer that it was C. Ditto in tactile systems, allowing you to tell that it was this smidgen of skin that was just touched, not a little this way or that. Or the ears, telling you it was definitely an A, not an A-sharp or an A-flat. Thus, what we've seen is another example of contrast enhancement in the nervous system. What is the significance of the fact that the silent state of a neuron is negatively charged, rather than a neutral 0 millivolts? It's a way of sharpening a signal within a neuron. Feedback, feed-forward, and lateral inhibition? A way of sharpening a signal within a circuit. Two different types of pain. Neuron A's dendrites sit just below the surface of the skin, and the neuron has an action potential in response to a painful stimulus. Neuron A then stimulates neuron B, which projects up the spinal cord, letting you know that something painful just happened. But neuron A also stimulates neuron C, which inhibits B. This is one of our feed-forward inhibitory circuits. Result? Neuron B fires for a while and then is silenced, and you perceive this as a sharp pain. You've been poked with a needle. Meanwhile, there's neuron D, whose dendrites are in the same general area of the skin and respond to a different type of painful stimulus. As before, neuron D excites neuron B, and the message is sent up to the brain. But it also sends projections to neuron C, where it inhibits it. Result, when neuron D is activated by a pain signal, it inhibits the ability of neuron C to inhibit neuron B. and you perceive it as a throbbing, continuous pain, like a burn or abrasion. Importantly, this is reinforced further by the fact that action potentials travel down the axon of neuron D much slower than in neuron A, having to do with that myelin that I mentioned earlier. Details aren't important. So the pain in neuron A's world is not only transient, but also fast. Pain in the neuron D branch is not only long-lasting, but also has a slower onset. The two classes of fibers can interact, and we often intentionally force them to. Suppose that you have some sort of continuous throbbing pain, say an insect bite. How can you stop the throbbing? Briefly stimulate the fast fiber. This adds to the pain for an instant, but by stimulating neuron C, you shut the system down for a while. And that is precisely what we often do in such circumstances. An insect bite throbs unbearably. We scratch hard right around it to dull the pain, and the slow, chronic pain pathway is shut down for up to a few minutes. The fact that pain works this way has important clinical implications. For one thing, it has allowed scientists to design treatments for people with severe chronic pain syndromes, for example, someone with a severe back injury. Implanting a little electrode into the fast pain pathway and attaching it to a stimulator on the person's hip enables the patient to buzz that pathway now and then to turn off the chronic pain. It works wonders in many cases. Thus, we have a circuit that encompasses a temporal sharpening mechanism, introduces the double negative of inhibiting inhibitors, and is just all around cool. And one of the biggest reasons why I love it is that it was first proposed in 1965 by the great neurobiologists Ronald Melzack and Patrick Wall. It was merely proposed as a theoretical model. No one has ever seen this sort of wiring, but we propose that it's got to look something like this, given how pain works. And subsequent work showed that's exactly how this part of the nervous system is wired. Which guy is it? One final, completely hypothetical circuit. Imagine we have a circuit made of two layers of neurons. Neuron A projects to neurons 1, 2, and 3. Neuron B projects to 2, 3, and 4, etc. Now let's show how hypothetical this circuit is by giving neurons A, B, and C completely imaginary functions. Neuron A responds to a guy we'll call X. B to a guy we'll call Y. C to a guy we'll call Z. What can neuron 1 learn? How to recognize that particular guy. Neuron 5 is equally specialized. But what can neuron 3 learn? Neuron 3's knowledge is general and comes from the overlap of the first layer's projections. Neurons 2 and 4 are also generalist neurons, but they're less accurate because they have only two exemplars each. So neuron 3 is at the convergent center of this network, and the fanciest parts of the brain are wired up in a way that resembles this fairy tale circuit. Writ large, at the same time, neuron 3 is a more peripheral element in some other circuit, sending projections to it. Neuron 1 is at the very center of some other network in the fourth dimension, and so on. All of these neurons are embedded within multiple networks. What does this produce? The capacity for association, metaphor, analogy, parable, symbol. To link two disparate things, even from different sensory modalities. To Homerically associate the color of wine with the color of the sea. That both tomato and potato can be pronounced in two different ways in a song. That a bright red tongue sticking out can remind you of music by the Stones. It's why I associate Stravinsky and Picasso, given that albums, remember those, of Stravinsky's music always seem to have a Picasso painting on the cover. And it's why a rectangular piece of cloth with a distinctive pattern of colors on it can stand for an entire nation, or people, or ideology. A final point. We differ as to the nature and spread of our associative networks. And extremes of them can produce very interesting things at times. For example, most of us learned early on to associate a simple circle with two dots and a couple of lines with the concept of face. But then someone comes along whose associate networks of neuronal projections are broader, more idiosyncratic than everyone else's. And they teach the world that gazing at a Picasso figure can evoke faceness as well. What might we call the consequence of some types of atypically wide associative nets of neurons? Creativity. One more round of scaling up. A neuron, two neurons, a neuronal circuit. We're ready now, as a last step, to scale up to the level of thousands of neurons at once. Consider a slice of tissue viewed under a microscope. It's a homogeneous field of cells, all organized in roughly the same way. The top left corner and bottom left corner look exactly the same. If the brain were as homogeneous and boring as a liver cross-section, it would be an undifferentiated mass of tissue, with neuronal cell bodies carpeted evenly all over the place, sending out their processes every which way. Instead, there's a huge amount of internal organization. In other words, the cell bodies of neurons that have related functions are clumped together in particular regions of the brain, and the axons that they send to other parts of the brain are organized into projection cables. What all this means, crucially, is that different parts of the brain do different things. All the regions of the brain have names, usually multisyllabic and derived from Greek or Latin, as do the subregions and the sub-subregions. Moreover, each talks to a consistent collection of other regions, i.e. sends axons to them, and is talked to by a consistent collection, i.e. receives axonal projections from them. You can go crazy studying all this, as I've seen, tragically, in the case of many a neuroanatomist who relishes all these details. For our purposes, there are some key points. Each particular region contains millions of neurons, some familiar names at this level of analysis: hypothalamus, cerebellum, cortex, hippocampus. Some regions have very distinct and compact subregions, and each is referred to as a nucleus. This is confusing, as the part of every cell that contains the DNA is also called the nucleus. What can you do? Some probably totally unfamiliar names, just as examples, the basal nucleus of Meynert, the supraoptic nucleus of the hypothalamus, the charmingly named inferior olive nucleus. As described, the cell bodies of neurons with related functions are clumped together in their particular region, or nucleus, and send their axonal projections off in the same direction, merging together into a cable, a fiber tract. Back to that myelin wrapping around axons that helps action potentials propagate faster. Myelin tends to be white, sufficiently so that the fiber tract cables in the brain look white. Thus, they're generically referred to as white matter. A lot of the brain is taken up by the fiber tracts. All sorts of regions are talking to one another, often distant parts. Suppose you have someone who has sustained an injury in one particular part of the brain, mysterious spot X. This gives the opportunity to learn something about the brain by now seeing what no longer works right in the person. Neuroscience as a field really got its start thanks to studies of soldiers who had suffered missile projection wounds. Viewed in a detached manner, the endless 19th century European military bloodbaths were God's gift to neuroanatomists. The injured individual now does something abnormally. Can you conclude that spot X is the part of the brain responsible for the normal version of that behavior? Only if it's where a cluster of neuronal cell bodies are. If spot X is a fiber tract, you're actually learning something about the region of the brain whose neurons sent axonal projections in that fiber tract, and that region could be at the other end of the brain. So it's important to distinguish between neuronal nuclei and fibers of passage. Finally, back to the reference just now about a part of the brain being the center for some behavior. The examples from earlier in the chapter showed how hard it is to make sense of the function of an individual neuron without considering the network that it is a part of. Same theme here, writ large. Given that every brain region is getting projections from and sending projections to a zillion other places, it is rare that an individual brain region is the center for anything. Instead, it's all networks where, far more often, a particular region plays a key role in, helps mediate, or influences a behavior. The function of a particular brain region is embedded in the context of its connections. Thus, this concludes our Brain 101 primer. Appendix 2. The Basics of Endocrinology. Endocrinology is the study of hormones, very different sorts of messengers from the neurotransmitters of Chapter 2. As a recap, neurotransmitters are released from neurons' axon terminals in response to action potentials. Once released, they travel a microscopic distance across the synapse and bind to receptors on dendrites of the second postsynaptic neuron, thereby changing that neuron's excitability. In contrast, a hormone is a chemical messenger released from secretory cells, including neurons, in various glands. Once secreted, it enters the bloodstream, where it can influence any cells throughout the body that possess receptors for it. So right off the bat, we have key differences. First, neurotransmitters directly affect only neurons on the other side of synapses, while a hormone can potentially affect each of the trillions of cells in the body. A second difference is the time course. Neurotransmitter signaling across synapses occurs in milliseconds. In contrast, many hormonal effects emerge over hours to days and can persist forever. For example, how often does puberty go away after a while? Neurotransmitters and hormones also differ in the scale of their effects. A neurotransmitter binds to its postsynaptic receptor, resulting in a local change in the flow of ions across the membrane of that dendritic spine. But depending on the hormone and the target cell being considered, hormones can change the activity of particular proteins, turn certain genes on or off, alter the metabolisms of cells, cause them to grow or atrophy, to divide or to shrivel up and die. Testosterone, for example, increases muscle mass, and progesterone causes the proliferation of cells in the uterus, causing it to thicken during the luteal phase. Conversely, thyroid hormone kills cells in a tadpole's tail as the animal is metamorphosizing into a frog, and a class of stress hormones can kill cells in the immune system, helping to explain how stress makes us vulnerable to getting a cold. Hormones are extremely versatile. Most hormones are part of a neuroendocrine axis. Recall from Chapter 2 how all roads in the limbic system lead to the hypothalamus, with its pivotal role in regulating the autonomic nervous system and hormonal systems. Here's where the second part comes in. Neurons in the hypothalamus secrete a particular hormone that travels in a tiny local circulatory system connecting to the pituitary, just below the base of the brain. There, that hormone stimulates the secretion of a particular pituitary hormone, which enters the general circulation and stimulates the secretion of a third hormone from some peripheral gland. Here's an example involving my three favorite hormones. During stress, hypothalamic neurons secrete CRH, corticotropin-releasing hormone, which stimulates pituitary cells to secrete ACTH, adrenocorticotropic hormone. Once in the general circulation, ACTH gets to the adrenal glands, where it stimulates secretion of steroid stress hormones called glucocorticoids, with the human version being cortisol, aka hydrocortisone. Other hormones, e.g. estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, and thyroid hormone, are released from peripheral glands as the final step of their own hypothalamic/pituitary/peripheral gland axis. As a wonderful complication, the secretion of each particular pituitary hormone is often not under the control of only a single hypothalamic-releasing hormone. Instead, there are multiple types of hormones serving that function, and other hypothalamic hormones that inhibit that particular pituitary hormone's release. For example, an array of hypothalamic hormones in addition to CRH regulates the release of ACTH, where different types of stressors produce different combinations of those hypothalamic hormones. Not all hormones are regulated in this brain-slash-pituitary-slash-peripheral gland manner. In some cases, there's a brain-slash-pituitary two-step, where the pituitary hormone exerts effects throughout the body. Growth hormone generally fits this pattern. In other systems, the brain sends projections down the spine and to a particular gland, helping to regulate its hormone release. The pancreas and its secretion of insulin are an example, where circulating glucose levels are the main regulator. Then there are weirdo hormones, secreted from unlikely places, like the heart or gut, where the brain regulates secretion only indirectly. Hormones, like neurotransmitters, are made cheaply. They are constructed in just a few biosynthetic steps from plentiful precursors, either simple proteins or cholesterol. Moreover, the body generates multiple types of hormones from the same precursor. For example, the numerous steroid hormones are all generated from cholesterol. So far, we've given short shrift to hormone receptors. They do the same general job as do neurotransmitter receptors. There is a distinctive receptor molecule for each type of hormone, with a concave binding domain whose shape is complementary to the shape of the hormone. To trot out the same cliché as was used for neurotransmitters, a hormone fits into its receptor like a key fits into a lock. And as with neurotransmitter receptors, there's no free lunch with hormone receptors. The various steroid hormones are structurally similar. Thus, if you're cheap at the production end, you need subtle, fancy receptors that differentiate among those similar hormones. You do not want receptors that confuse, say, estrogen and testosterone. Hormone/neurotransmitter similarities continue. Like neurotransmitter receptors, a hormone receptor's avidity for its hormone can change. This means that the shape of the binding site changes a bit so that the hormone now fits more or less snugly, thus increasing or decreasing the duration of the hormone's effect. The number of receptors for a particular hormone in a cell can also change, altering the cell's sensitivity to that hormone's effect. The number of receptors in a target cell can be as important as the levels of the hormone itself, and there are endocrine diseases where normal levels of hormone are secreted, but because of a mutation in the hormone's receptor, no signal gets through. Hormone levels are akin to how loudly someone speaks. Receptor levels are akin to the acuity with which ears detect that voice. Finally, receptors for a hormone typically occur in only a subset of cells and tissues in the body, meaning that only those are responsive to the hormone. For example, only tail cells contain receptors for thyroid hormone when tadpoles are turning into frogs. Similarly, only some types of breast cancer involve tumors whose cells are ER-positive, i.e. they contain estrogen receptors and are responsive to the growth-promoting effects of the hormone. This is our overview of how hormones alter the functions of target cells over the course of hours to days. Hormones were highly pertinent in Chapter 7 when considering the effects of hormones in childhood and fetal life. Specifically, hormones can have permanent organizational effects during development, shaping how the brain is constructed. In contrast, activational effects persist for hours to days. These two domains interact in that organizational hormone effects on a fetal brain influence what activational effects hormones will have on that brain in adulthood. Back to the main text to consider specific hormones. Appendix 3. Protein basics. Proteins are a class of organic compounds that are the most abundant molecules in living systems. They are hugely important since numerous hormones, neurotransmitters, and messengers of the immune system are made of protein, ditto for the receptors that respond to those messengers, the enzymes that construct or degrade them, the scaffolding that shapes a cell, and so on. A key feature of proteins is their shape, since the shape of a protein determines its function. Proteins that form the scaffolding of a cell have the shape of the different crossbars and scaffolding at construction sites, sort of. A protein hormone will have a distinctive shape that is unique and distinctively different from the shape of a hormone that has different effects. And a protein receptor must have a shape that is complementary to the shape of the hormone or neurotransmitter that it binds. Back to the time-honored cliche of Appendix 1, namely that a messenger like a hormone fits into its receptor like a key into a lock. Some proteins change their shape, typically moving between two conformations. Suppose you have an enzyme, again a protein, that synthesizes a molecule of sucrose by linking a molecule of glucose to a molecule of fructose. The enzyme must have one conformation that resembles the letter V, where one end binds a glucose molecule at a particular angle, the other fructose. The binding of both triggers the enzyme to shift to its other conformation, where the two ends of the V move close enough for the glucose and fructose to be linked. The sucrose floats off, and the enzyme flips back to its original conformation. What determines the shape and function of a protein? Any given protein is made of a string of amino acids. There are about 20 different types of amino acids, including some familiar ones like tryptophan and glutamate. Each protein's string of amino acids is unique, like the string of letters that composes a word. Your typical protein is about 300 amino acids long, and with 20 different amino acid types, there are nearly 10 to the 400th power possible sequences. That's 10 followed by 400 zeros. More atoms than there are in the universe. The amino acid sequence of a protein influences the unique shape or shapes of that protein. Dogma used to be that amino acid sequence determines the shape or shapes of that protein, but it turns out that the shape is also subtly altered by things like temperature and acidity. In other words, environmental influences. And what determines the sequence of amino acids that are strung together to form a particular protein? A particular gene. DNA as the blueprint for constructing proteins. DNA is another class of organic compounds, and just as there are roughly 20 different types of amino acids, there are four different letters, called nucleotides, that make up DNA. A sequence of three nucleotides, called a codon, codes for a single amino acid. If there are four different types of nucleotides, and each codon is three nucleotides long, there can be a total of 64 different codons. Four possibilities in the first place, times four in the second, times four in the third, equals 64. A few of those 64 are reserved to signal the end of a gene, and after eliminating those stop codons, there are 61 different codons coding for 20 different amino acids. Therefore, there is redundancy. Almost all amino acids can be specified by more than one unique codon, an average of about 3, i.e. 61 divided by 20. Typically, the different codons coding for the same amino acid differ by only a single nucleotide. For example, four different codon sequences code for the amino acid alanine. GCA, GCC, GCG, and GCT. A, C, G, and T are the abbreviations for the four types of nucleotides. Redundancy will be important for understanding gene evolution. The entire stretch of nucleotides that codes for a single type of protein is called a gene. The entire collection of DNA is called the genome, coding for all of the tens of thousands of genes in an organism. Sequencing the genome means determining the unique sequence of the billions of nucleotides that make up that organism's genome. That stretch of DNA is so long, containing roughly 20,000 genes in humans, that it has to be broken into separate volumes, called chromosomes. This produces a spatial problem. The DNA library is found in the center of the cell, in the nucleus. Proteins, however, occur all over the cell, are constructed all over it. Just think of proteins in the axon terminals of a spinal neuron in a blue whale, terminals that are light years away from that neuron's nucleus. How do you get the DNA information out to where the protein is made? There is an intermediary that completes the picture. The unique nucleotide sequence in DNA that codes for a particular gene is copied into a string of similar nucleotide letters in a related compound called RNA. Any given chromosome contains a staggeringly long stretch of DNA, coding for one gene after another. In contrast, this stretch of RNA is only as long as the particular gene. In other words, a more manageable length. That RNA is then shipped to wherever it is supposed to be in the cell, where it then directs which amino acids are strung together in which sequence to form a protein. And there are amino acids floating around in a cell ready to be grabbed for the protein construction project. Think of RNA as a photocopy of a single page out of this vast 20,000-page-long DNA encyclopedia. And multiple copies of the cognate protein can be made from the instructions in a photocopy page of RNA. This sure helps in circumstances where copies of the protein must wind up in each of the thousands of a single neuron's axon terminals. This produces what is termed the central dogma of life, a concept first framed in the early 1960s by Francis Crick, half of the renowned Watson and Crick, who discovered the double helix structure of DNA, with more than a little purloined help from Rosalind Franklin, but that's another story. Crick's central dogma holds that the nucleotide sequence of DNA that composes a gene determines how a unique stretch of RNA is put together, which determines how a unique stretch of amino acids are put together, which determines the shape or shapes of the resulting protein, which determines that protein's function. DNA determines RNA determines protein. And implicit in that central dogma is another critical point. One type of gene specifies one type of protein. Just for everyone's sanity, I'm going to mostly ignore RNA. For our purposes, what is interesting is what genes, the starting point, have to do with their end products, proteins and their functions. Mutations and polymorphisms. Genes are inherited from your parents, half the genes from each. Not entirely true, as covered in the main text. Suppose that when someone's DNA genome is being copied for inclusion in their egg or sperm, a mistake is made in the copying of one single nucleotide. With billions of nucleotides, that's bound to happen sometimes. As a result, unless corrected, the gene, now with its nucleotide sequence erroneously differing in one spot, is passed on to an offspring. This is a mutation. In classical genetics, there are three types of mutations that can occur. The first is called a point mutation. One single nucleotide is copied incorrectly. Will this change the amino acid sequence of the protein coded for? It depends. Back to redundancy in the DNA code from a few paragraphs ago. Suppose there is a codon in a gene with the sequence GCT, coding for alanine. But there has been a mutation, yielding GCA instead. No problem, that still codes for alanine. It's an inconsequential, neutral mutation. But suppose the mutation instead was GAT. This codes for a completely different amino acid called asparagine. Uh-oh. In actuality, though, this may not be a big deal, if the new amino acid looks a lot like the one that was lost. Suppose you have a nucleotide sequence coding for the following metaphorical amino acid sequence. I/am/now/going/to/do/the/following. Thanks to a subtle mutation, there is a change of one amino acid, but one without a ton of consequences. I/am/now/going/ta slash do slash the slash following. This would still be comprehensible to most people. The protein would merely be perceived as coming from New York. Translated into proteinese, the protein has a slightly different shape and does its usual task a bit differently, maybe a little slower or faster. Not the end of the world. But if the mutation codes for an amino acid that produces a protein with a dramatically different shape, the consequences can be enormous, even fatal. Back to I slash am now slash going slash to slash do slash the slash following. What if there is a mutation in a nucleotide helping to code for the first W, a mutation with a big consequence? I slash am slash not slash going slash to slash do slash the slash following. Trouble. The next type of classical mutation is called a deletion mutation. In this scenario, a copying error is made during the inheritance of a gene. But instead of a nucleotide being miscopied, it is deleted. For example, in a case where the seventh nucleotide is deleted, I slash am slash now slash going slash to slash do slash the slash following becomes I slash am slash now slash oinked slash odd slash ought slash hef slash allowing. This can frame shift everything over to generate gibberish or even a different message, e.g., for dessert I'd like the moose, mutating to, for dessert, I'd like the mouse. Deletion mutations can involve the loss of more than a single nucleotide. At an extreme, this can involve the deletion of the entire gene, or even a stretch of genes on a particular chromosome. Definitely not good. Finally, there are insertion mutations. During copying of the DNA to pass on to the next generation, a nucleotide is inadvertently copied twice. Duplicated. Thus, I slash am slash now slash going slash to slash do slash the slash following becomes I slash am slash now slash going slash good slash odd slash auth slash e following. Gibberish, or perhaps a different message, as in the following case, where an E has been inserted near the end of the string of letters. Mary turned John down for a date because she did not enjoy bowling. In some cases, an insertion mutation can involve the insertion of more than a single nucleotide. At an extreme, this can even involve the duplication of an entire gene. Point deletion and insertion mutations are most of what mutations are about. Deletion and insertion mutations often have major consequences, usually deleterious, but sometimes produce a new, interesting protein. Back to point mutations. Consider one that results in the substitution of a single amino acid in the protein, one that works a bit differently from the correct amino acid. As noted above, as a result, the protein still does its old job, but maybe does it a bit faster or slower. This could be the grist for evolutionary change. If the new version is disadvantageous, reducing the reproductive success of anyone who carries it, it will be gradually selected against, removing it from a population. If instead, the new version is more advantageous, it will gradually replace the old one in a population. Or, if the new version works better than the original in some circumstances, but worse in others, it may reach equilibrium in the population with the original version, where a certain percentage of people have the old version, the remainder the new. In this case, the particular gene would be described as coming in two different forms, or variants, as coming with two different alleles. Most genes come with multiple alleles, and the result is individual variation in the functioning of genes. This is covered in far more complexity in Chapter 8. Finally, a clarification of the confusion where two soundbites about genetics collide. The first is that, on the average, full, non-identical twin siblings share 50% of their genes. The other is that we share 98% of our genes with chimps. So are we more related to chimps than to our siblings? No. comparisons between humans and chimps are about types of traits. We both have genes coding for traits related to having, for example, eyes, muscle fibers, or dopamine receptors, and both lack genes related to having, for example, gills, antennae, or flower petals. So there's 98% overlap at that level of comparison. But comparison between any two humans is about versions of those traits. Both have a gene that codes for, say, this thing called eye color, but do they share the version that codes for the same particular color? Same for blood type, type of dopamine receptor, and so on. We have 50% overlap with siblings at this level of comparison. This is Michael Goldstrom. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Behave, The Biology of Humans at Our Best and Worst by Robert M. Sapolsky. This program was directed by Francis Loy. Executive producer, Janet Stark. Text copyright 2017 by Robert M. Sapolsky. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.